You are listening to the Podkiss Network.
What number is this, Chip?
Episode zero, zilch.
Okay, no, I mean, like, don't get excited, man. It's because I'm short, I know.
Zilch. You're listening to Zilch, a Monkees podcast.
This is not the Podkiss. You are listening to what we're going to call
Zilch, a Monkees podcast.
Yes, you heard that right. The Podkiss crew is taking on the Monkees. And we are joined by Mr. Chris Karam.
Hello, hello, hello.
Mr. Craig Cohen.
Hi there.
And the ever wonderful Jeff Hewlett.
Oh, what an intro. How's it going?
Craig and Jeff, they run a Star Trek podcast. Would you gentlemen like to tell us about it?
The Star Trek podcast we run is called the Tricorder Transmissions. It's focused on the original series, and what we do on our regular episodes is we cover a single episode of the original series in broadcast order, and we do a scene-specific commentary on each episode. So what that means is we'll do a count in, and if you want to watch along, you can have your DVD, your Blu-ray, your Netflix, and you start it at the end of our countdown, and essentially we'll talk over the whole thing, kind of like Mystery Science Theater. We will kind of talk through the different scenes. We'll talk about the actors, the directors, the writers, correlations between the different shows, some references, and of course, a little trivia bits and things along the way.
And Chris, I'm going to put you on the spot. You're going to start doing a Led Zeppelin podcast soon.
Oh, wow. So.
Well, now I have to.
Now you have to.
Now I have to. Yeah, it's in the works. It's I don't know when it'll be, but it'll be at some point in the future.
Excellent.
We've had a lot of people that are interested in the Monkees, and here we are. We're finally doing it after a bunch of talking about it. We did our Beatles special, and it seemed to go good. So tonight we're just going to talk about the concept of the Monkees. Is it relevant? What was it that attracted us to it? We're also going to talk about things like who our favorite Monkees were, whether the Monkees were a band or a TV show, what our favorite albums are. So we're going to start right now. Chris, are the Monkees a band or a TV show? Now, well, I know that they can be both. In the real world, they can be both. But for the sake of our discussion, that's the question. Are the Monkees a band or a TV show? Chris Karam.
I guess I'd have to say a TV show. Because that's Chris. How I discovered them. That's where it began for me. So, yeah, a TV show.
Do you have the DVDs of the TV show?
Yes, I have both seasons.
Mr. Craig Cohen, band or TV show?
For me, even though I discovered the band through the TV show, to me they're a band simply because as great as the TV show is, it's ultimately a delivery system for their music.
Ah, great point, great point. And it also was a delivery system for merchandise and commercials.
Yeah.
In a sense, they, along with the Beatles, were way ahead before the folks in Kiss ever were. So Kiss has nothing on these other bands. Jeff, your thoughts, band or TV show, and why?
I'm going to say they were a TV show that became a band.
Ooh, the real answer right there.
Sort of because of the fame that they arrived at once they became a real band, they all started to fracture and go off in their own directions and not focus on the music as much and degraded after the fact and wound up, you know, phasing themselves out.
Excellent summation.
Here we come, walking down the street.
They were four young men hired by Hollywood to play a make-believe band.
Mickey, Peter, Mike, and Davey. What young men in America wouldn't have given their eye teeth to get that gig?
We're the Monkees.
Hey, hey, we're the Monkees.
The Monkees is a bigger phenomenon than I'd ever planned or hoped for myself.
They did not want to just hire four actors to play parts and pretend.
Take the last train to Pottsville and I'll meet you.
We were 19, 20, 21 years old. We weren't thinking. We were just doing.
This is TV, partner. This is the great American narcotic machine at work.
The local rock group down the street is trying hard to learn their song.
The Monkees were not allowed to play their own instruments.
I didn't have any ambivalence about how the music was being made. I hated it.
Another Pleasant Valley Sunday.
They fought to make their own records, seizing control in a high-stakes musical mutiny.
I smashed my fist through the wall. I said, yeah, well, that could have been your face.
The year that I got fired, I had the Monkees outselling the Beatles.
Then the fictional Monkees became a real live band.
I've often equated it to Leonard Nimoy really becoming a Vulcan.
This Vulcan line, Mickey, give it up for God's sake.
Look out, here comes tomorrow.
They won the battle to be their own band, but the victory led to their destruction.
I mean, whoever plays Superman shouldn't be jumping off buildings, you know, thinking he can fly either.
When the 60s ended, the Monkees were history.
Well, that's show business.
They weren't hip, they weren't cool, but two decades later, they were back.
You always say you like my style.
We had sold-out concerts all over the place.
It's just so odd to me that a girl my age would be attracted to my father.
Listen to the band.
Then the Monkees' comeback fell victim to bad blood and bruised egos.
We've all quit at one time or another now.
Now, the real-life adventures of the most beloved made-up band in rock and roll history, the comedy and tragedy of the Monkees.
Now, when you think about it, if we're just to look at the Monkees as just a recording act, you take a look at their discography, and from 1966 to 1968, they put out 6 albums. Mm-hmm. That is insane. Nowadays, you get 2 albums in 6 years if you're lucky. The amount of stuff that they produced is just staggering, while producing a TV show and going on tour and then eventually making a movie.
Yeah.
Not to mention all the other guest appearances on other TV shows and TV specials and stuff like that. It's just, when you look at what the Beatles and the Stones and all the groups back then had to churn out over the amount of time that they did, it's just amazing.
Staggering.
And, you know, we as KISS fans have been dealing with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as of late. And I think it's very sad that the Monkees have yet to be in there. I'm not going to start a petition. I don't really care. But if there's going to be a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the Monkees need to be in there as well.
And definitely.
A lot Agreed. Of people would say, well, you know, because it would ultimately come up, well, why isn't, you know, KISS in there? And I'd say, well, they should be in there, and they're no different than the Monkees. And people say, what do you mean? The Monkees aren't a real group. And I'm like, you haven't listened to them. If anyone doesn't understand the importance of Monkee music in popular cultures, especially in the 60s, and even through now, the 80s, and up until today, they're missing out on a lot of great tunes. They've set Definitely. Quite a few records, as a matter of fact. Between 1966 and 1970, the Monkees released 185 songs on 9 stereo albums, 5 mono albums, and 9 non-LP singles. The final song they recorded was? Anybody know?
Not off the top.
It's Got to Be Love.
But it feels like love, makes me weak like love, and it takes.
Now, you guys are from the Star Trek universe. A bit of monkey business going on in the Star Trek world. You guys discussed the classic TV show. Would you like to discuss some of the little cross-cultural things that happened there?
Sure. I think the most obvious one is in the second season, they introduced Ensign Chekov, who was pretty much injected into the series to act as the Davy Jones of Star Trek. And even though Walter Koenig didn't have the hair for it yet, in certain episodes you can see him wearing a Davy Jones wig, if you will.
Yeah. He had the eyebrows already.
Yes.
Unfortunately, though, the tambourine got lost in the during transport.
Yeah, when they were beaming them aboard, the tambourine got lost. So these things will happen, which is why Bones would never enter.
He didn't want to end up as Chekhov's tambourine.
Exactly. And, Jeff, you were telling me one day that Mike Nesmith's coat was used in an episode of Star Trek?
Yes. Actually, it was used in the episode that featured the character Trelane, which is the Squire of Gothos. The Trelane character himself was wearing a quite ornate jacket that Mike Nesmith also wore, I believe, in a Mary Mary performance on the show.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and actually there's an actor connection as well. The first aired episode of the Monkees, The Royal Flush? Is that the name of it?
Yes, yes.
Is it Otto?
Yes.
Theo Marcus, he appeared on the episode of Star Trek Cat's Paw.
And it's strange because if you watch the movie Head, there's that scene, you know, where they're at war. And there's the guy that's the football player in the hole that keeps smacking into Peter. You guys know what I'm talking about?
Yep.
That one hole in the side of the mountain is the Batcave. So there's so many cool little backlot things that you can find if you look around. It's just pretty interesting. Your answer was excellent, that they were a TV show that became a band. I don't think that a lot of people that aren't into the Monkees appreciate what they were able to do within and without the system. They basically became independent artists within the system. Here's your writers, here's your producers, here's your songs you have to do. And they basically went in and over time became their own bosses in a sense musically. That almost never happens. They were very subversive, and I don't think that a lot of people give them the credit even to this day for what they were able to do. Because, for example, while the Stones and the Beatles may have just put something out there and people had to deal with it or whatever, the Monkees came in and brought people like Tim Buckley, Frank Zappa, and they brought and even the Frotis Caper.
The first TV show dedicated to marijuana.
Yes, it was the whole episode was about getting high and all that stuff, and they were able to be subversive through the back door of the Smiling Monkees, and parents looked at them as an innocent property, if you will.
A manufactured image with no philosophies.
Exactly. Yeah.
As a young child, I got into the resurgence of the Monkees in the late 80s, in the 1987 area when the show came back on Nickelodeon, I believe it was. They started running the old Monkees episodes again. My uncle is an audiophile. He's an audio engineer. He's got, I can't even tell you how many records, but I spent my entire youth being brought up by an audiophile and being forced to listen to all sorts of music. And he developed my musical taste with the Beatles. But the Monkees were actually my first favorite band. So when they started to come back around in the late 80s, he actually owned all of their material. So he would play me all of their records as we watched the TV shows. And actually, my first concert in 1987 was the Monkees, and opened up with Weird Al Yankovic. So nice. That kind of was my bread and butter back then, and I wound up collecting everything that they put out, and a lot of rarities and bootlegs and all sorts of things. So that was my first obsession band.
Craig Cohen.
My experience is very similar to Jeff's, minus the audiophile uncle. It was mainly, you know, me and my older brother sort of just finding the Monkees there when they started rerunning the episodes on Nickelodeon, thinking the show was incredibly funny, but then also had the added bonus of having all these really, really great tunes that stuck in your head.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. The music is so infectious. Chris Karam.
Well, I discovered the Monkees through the magic of syndicated television on Channel 56 in Boston.
Boston.
And, you know, I look back on it. It's funny. I think the Monkees really were my first band, although I consider Kiss to be my first band. I think back then I just viewed it as a fun show with music, you know, a lot of laughs and music. But I didn't go out and buy Monkees records till much, much later. And then, like, you know, by the 80s when I was listening to other groups, I'd forgotten about the Monkees. Then the 20th anniversary came around with the MTV marathons and the Then and Now compilation, and that just kickstarted it for me. And what was great about that was when I started buying the Rhino Records reissues, it was like, oh, I remember that song. It all came back to me 10 years later.
Absolutely. And, you know, we as Monkee fans are blessed to have them on the Rhino label.
Absolutely.
Because what they have been able to do has been mind-blowing. It's just staggering the amount of Monkees material that is out there. What they've been able to do, both as a packaging label and what they've done audio-wise, has just been amazing. And there is no shortage of great Monkee material out there. And when you think about, like, the original lineup of the Monkees only had those, what, 6 albums? Mm-hmm. They were recording constantly.
Yes.
If they weren't in the studio, Like if a Monkee wasn't needed in a scene, he might be across the hallway recording tracks for the albums. The stuff that we've never heard until recently, even. It's just absolutely amazing. So praise God that they wound up on Rhino, and I'm serious about that, because what they've been able to do, it's been a Monkees fan dream come true, wouldn't you say?
I absolutely agree with that. I've been able to pick up all of the special editions that Rhino's put out over the last few years, starting with the Headquarters sessions, all the way up through the most recent, which was the reissue of the Monkees Present in these large box formats. And what they've been able to do, not only with the sound quality, but with the extras that they've thrown in. I mean, there's multiple discs. So you get not only do you get the mono and stereo versions of all the albums, you get a ton of alternate versions of the songs. A lot of them were sung by multiple Monkees. You know, they would test out the song with Mickey singing, and they would test it out with Mike singing, or they'd try it with Peter, and it wouldn't work out, so they'd throw Davey on it. It's amazing to hear a lot of these songs sung by other Monkees, and you're just not used to hearing them that way.
Because I've been hearing some of these songs since, well, the albums came out.
Sure.
And now it's great to hear these different versions, and it's just fantastic. I guess that I have to say that when the Monkees were on TV the first time, they got me. That was one of the shows that was cool to watch, along with Star Trek and Batman and things like that. And it was just fun, and it could make your grandmother laugh as much as it would make you laugh. From teenagers to kids, somebody could get something out of the Monkees TV show. I remember my one aunt buying the first album, and I remember my uncle, he was the first person that said, well, they don't play their own instruments. And it became that whole thing. And I remember reading the covers even before, it seemed like before I could read, I was trying to figure out what was going on these album covers all through my life, whether it be a Beatle album cover or a Monkees album cover, the Kinks or so on and whatever. And it was just fun to try to put it all together. Then it seemed like the show went into syndication, and you would see it on Saturday mornings on CBS. It became part of the CBS lineup. And it was kind of cool because you'd watch the Monkees, then later you'd watch Bandstand, and then eventually Soul Train would come on. So it was like a cool music thing for someone that was into music. I was never much into the sports. I was into arts, comics, and comedy, and you know, music. So this was more where I was headed. And
hey, Ken, yes. I wanted to put this out there. I just want to backtrack a little bit. I'm going to put this out there and see what you guys think. I think Rhino Records has actually done a better job as caretakers of the Monkees catalog than Capital EMI with the Beatles.
Amen. Absolutely true.
I thought that might be controversial, but...
No, it's not controversial at all. If Rhino would have got a hold of the Beatles catalog, this last box set that came out, the Beatles in the USA, it would have been a true set of the USA mixes. It would have been all of that and more.
Absolutely.
If you ever have a band, pray that Rhino picks them up and just does the same kind of job that they did on the Monkees, and you'll be a happy fan, trust me.
Rhino just put in an offer for podcasts, so...
Oh, well, good. They can get all the outtakes and stuff.
You know, I think the difference is with Rhino is I truly believe that Rhino was focusing on the fans when they put this material together for release. And as great as the 2009 Beatles remasters were of the British LPs, sound quality-wise, they're phenomenal. But they were just that. They were remasters.
Right.
They didn't really put out fan material. There wasn't a lot of bonus stuff that they threw out there for you. Whereas these Monkees reissues, even from the first record, which was just kind of like a double disc gatefold thing, they still put out a ton of bonus material. Mm-hmm. So it was really worth your time to pick all of this stuff up.
And even though I've had to rebuy a few things, I do not mind it in any way, because what you get is so amazing.
Absolutely.
What I was saying about coming up with the Monkees, I remember that the same uncle who was like skeptical, I remember him putting those records on anyway. And I remember him putting on a show on my grandmother's porch. They had all the girls in the neighborhood came by. And I think they had three guitars and the drummer had one drum, a cymbal, and the bass drum. Like, that's all he could put together. And they made a group and they like figured out, you know, how to do Stepping Stone and, you know, a few Kink songs like You Really Got Me and things like that. And it was just great Paul Revere narrator type garage rock. So I just remember my mom and her sisters being part of the neighborhood girls, and it was a great memory.
Right now it's my pleasure to introduce one of the hottest groups and the most professional groups to ever hit show business. Ladies and gentlemen, the Monkees. Hey! Stop!
And in the 70s, I remember going to this place called a library. You know, before you had the internet, you had this thing called the library where you would go to try to find out information about things. And you would find these books that would have, like, encyclopedias about bands, for example. And I remember hearing songs on the TV show that I couldn't find on any of the records that I had.
Yep.
And, you know, there were songs that, for example, when the Arista Greatest Hits came out, I had a couple of those tracks. So that was really exciting to find that. But I remember finding all these albums, and it took me well into, like, 1981 to realize that even after the Monkees continued, and they did Instant Replay and the Monkees Present, and then eventually those were without Peter Tork, and then after that Mike Nesmith left, and it just left Mickey Dolenz and Davy Jones to do changes in 1970. The group went through some different lineups and permutations. It was so weird to find out that they had continued on, because I always thought that, okay, there was the Kellogg commercials, they're on TV, here are the albums, okay, it's over, now you're in syndication, but it just kept on going. And the Monkees have always been present in our culture, it seems. They keep bubbling up. Every time you think they're gone, they bubble back up. One of the amazing things that happened with the Monkees coming back in the 80s was we got to have those re-releases on vinyl and eventually on CD of the Monkees. And even though I had a bunch of them, I remember going to the store and just, you know, buying, like, as many Monkee albums as I could. But that's kind of my little Monkee story. I think since we've discussed the 80s comeback, what are your thoughts on that, guys?
Well, I mean, I'm very glad it happened, because it brought me back into it, and it's kept me in there since. You know, like I said before, I'd just kind of forgotten about them by that point. I was into Kiss and heavy metal and all that kind of stuff, and you know, I was hanging out at a friend's college dorm room, and they had the Monkees marathon. I'm like, oh, the Monkees are on, and then, you know, I'm like, cool, you know, and then I. You know, a few months later, they came out with the Then and Now compilation with that new song, That Was Then, This Is Now, yeah. And it just reawakened it for me, and just like, oh, these guys are great, this is awesome, you know, this is really fun stuff. You know, because to me, the Monkees are just about fun, pure fun. There's no, you know, heavy dogma, there's no heavy political stuff, it's just, and I've got a question for you guys.
Sure.
When you guys listen to Cuddly Toy, do you find yourself doing that Davy Jones dance?
All yes.
The little shoulder thing with, you know, it's kind of like an old vaudeville thing. I'm in the car and I'm you know, my shoulders are swaying back and forth, you know. There's certain Davy Jones songs that just make me want to put on a, you know, top hat and get my cane out and do a little soft shoe, you know.
It's so funny you mentioned that song, because I was driving into work the other day and that song actually came on. I have a randomizer in my car with a little flash drive plugged in, and I'm singing along with this thing as I pulled into work with the window down. As I pull into this parking spot next to me, there's somebody sitting in the car next to me, and I'm kind of just singing along with the, you're not the only choo-choo train, and I'm like, oh boy. This guy's like looking at me like, what the hell's wrong with this guy?
Now, we were talking earlier about how the Monkees were bringing subversive elements into things. That's one of the examples. That song was written by Harry Nilsson, and it's about a groupie. And along with Davy Jones singing Star Collector about a girl who not only collects autographs, but rock stars in her bed. So, you know, those are just a couple examples of how the Monkees, whether it be music, visually, or whatever, they brought some subversive elements into middle America. And it's really amazing. Those Rhino reissues were just amazing. And the TV show, it seemed like they fed off one another.
Mm-hmm.
And just like it did when it first came out. And it was strange seeing girls who were 15 at the time that Davy Jones was, what, 35, 40, whatever, saying, oh, Davy, or oh, Mickey, you know what I mean? It was just kind of bizarre. But it worked, and I think it still works today. As a matter of fact, they're on, Antenna TV, I think it is? Anyway, I saw somebody posting on Facebook, and this girl was like, Davy's my favorite Monkee. And this, you know, Davy has passed. He's went on, sadly. Yeah. And he's still influencing TV teenage girls everywhere. Yeah. So somewhere today, somebody's seeing their first Monkee episode or hearing their first Monkee song getting turned on. So that's very cool. My wife tells me I'm wrong about this, but we're going to get to this next thing. Who is your favorite Monkee? I'm going to say Mike Nesmith, and my wife tells me I'm wrong, that it's Mickey Dolenz. She just said I'm wrong from the other room. She is a huge Mickey Dolenz fan. She's met him, and she's always enjoyed his vocal abilities, and we recently picked up his last album that he put out. It was a very good album. But I'm a big Mike guy, and I don't know what's up with me, but I always am gravitated towards the lead guitar player in the band. Like, for example, when I was coming up with Kiss, I was into Ace Frehley, the Beatles, George Harrison, Rick Nielsen, Cheap Trick, and Mike Nesmith, boom. For some reason, I like his subdued sense of humor, and I also love the songs that he writes, and I like his voice as well. Chris Karam, who is your favorite monkey?
It's a tough one, but I guess I'd have to say Mickey, with Mike being a close second. You know, Mickey's the crazy one. He's the, you know, I guess the lead singer, if you have to look at them in terms of having a defined role, although they all sing. But, you know, Mickey's the crazy one. He's, it's a funny thing, I woke up this morning, and the first song that popped in my head was Going Down.
Ah.
I must have been getting psyched for this podcast, but, and, you know, I don't know, I just like Mickey.
Now, see, that's one of those songs I couldn't find. You'd see it on TV, I could not find it. And then I was at a Goodwill store, I bought the 45, I forget which 45 it's on, someone's screaming, it's this one, Ken! But I remember getting that 45 and flipping it over and going, holy crap, this is that song that I could never find. And it was kind of bizarre. Craig, who's your favorite monkey and why?
It's funny, I think you helped me sort of key into it with the whole gravitating towards guitar players. I'm very similar in that sense, Ken. I am a guitar player, and growing up, my two biggest influences were Ace Frehley and Angus Young. But I can definitely see myself gravitating, like I did, to Mike Nesmith for that reason. And also, the age I got into the Monkees, seeing a guy wearing a wool hat, you know, regardless of whether the weather called for it or not, was just so incredibly cool to me. And he also wrote my favorite Monkees song, Listen to the Band. So I think you wrap all that up, and Mike comes out as my favorite monkey.
Well, by the way, I am wearing a wool hat, but I won't tell you where I had on my body.
Oh, boy, it's going to be one of those podcasts.
Jeff.
It's on his foot.
Yeah, it's on. Jeff, who is your favorite monkey and why?
Well, that's a really tough question to answer. I was kind of dreading when you got to this part, but it's going to wind up being going to have to go with Mike, but it's a 51-49 between Mickey and Mike, with Mike coming out on top. And the reason
by a narrow bit, right?
A very narrow margin, but the reason I'm going to tip it in Mike's favor is simply because he is the best songwriter in the group by a country mile, pun intended. And not only because the songs of his that made it onto the albums were great, but if you listen to some of the material that came out on the Missing Links albums and some of these Rhino reissues, some of the bonus tracks... There are some incredible, incredible Mike Nesmith songs that never made it out into the light of day. If you look at a song called Carlisle Wheeling, if you've never heard of that, unbelievable. If I ever get to Saginaw again, another incredible, incredible number. There are so many of them, I can't even list them all. Just go through and look for anyone that has the word Nesmith in parentheses after it and listen to it. And he was prolific. Prolific.
He was also ahead of his time.
Yes.
That just reminds me of something else I want to say. The Show, in my opinion, was ahead of its time.
Oh, The Show definitely. Yet, well,
especially for the 60s.
Yeah, but
or network TV rather.
Right. Now, but you also have to look at it like this: you have the Marx Brothers, you have the Monkees, you have the Beatles, you have the Monkees. Ingredients, the things that they called from, the things that they were told to do, and their sense of humor. You can definitely see it in the Marx Brothers and in the Beatles films as well. And that is not by accident. It may have been something new for television, but it was something that could have been sought out and seen in other forms. But you're right, it was the first time it was a weekly TV show where the kids ran the show.
Right, and wasn't John Lennon the first one to say that he saw them as kind of like a modern Marx Brothers?
Yeah, they asked John Lennon about the Monkees copying the Beatles, and he said, I don't think that they're copying the Beatles so much as they're doing the Marx Brothers. And that's the way John saw it, because it's absolutely true. It's that sense of anarchy and the liberation of anarchy and the joy of it that is found in almost every Monkees episode. So, fantastic.
And it had to give them some credibility, you know, to have the Beatles kind of acknowledge them, almost like, you know, like the Pope kissing, you know, they're kissing the Pope's ring and saying, okay, you're legitimate.
Well, Mickey has the famous story of him going to see them while they were working on Good Morning on Sgt. Pepper's album.
Yep.
They all partied together in England, and Mickey was called Monkey Man by John Lennon. I'll play a clip right now about that.
You, my friend, were at the sessions for Sgt. Pepper, a seminal rock and roll album by the Beatles, and chose to
record... Whatever happened to that album? It was so good, and it just disappeared off the face of the earth.
Oh, no, it hasn't.
I could never figure that out, how that album didn't take... No. Yes, I was blessed. I went to England on a press junket, actually, and I met Paul McCartney. We had sort of a press op, and he was very gracious. We had dinner, and we hung out, and he says, you want to come down and hear us? We're recording a new album, Sergeant Something, you know. And I'm like such a Beatle fan. I had my autograph book in my pocket, and I was just in awe. No, actually, I was in London, but it's near.
It's right outside of Awe, a couple miles away.
And so he invited me down to this session at Abbey Road Studios, this new album they were working on. And I don't know what I expected, I guess, you know, some sort of freak out Beatle mania, psycho jello, fun fest, love in, be in thing. So I got dressed up accordingly in my tie-dyed underwear and my paisley bell bottoms and my hair up in curlers and glasses. And, you know, three sheets to the wind. And in the middle of the day, it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the limo picks me up and brings me down to Abbey Road. And I walk in, you know, ready to party. And it looks like my high school gymnasium. It's fluorescent lighting, just the four guys in T-shirts and jeans, just sitting there playing. And I'm like, where are the girls? I look like a cross between Charlie Manson and Ronald McDonald. It's just ridiculous. And I remember it to this day. And John Lennon looks up at me and he says, "You want to hear?" He says, "Hey, Monkey Man." That's what he called me, Monkey Man.
Monkey Man.
Hey, Monkey Man. You want to hear what we're working on? And I'm like trying to be so cool. I'm such an idiot. And I'm going like, "Oh yeah, man, far out, dude. Yeah, it's cool, man. Far out." And he points up to George Martin, I'll never forget, up in the booth, and he's wearing a three-piece suit and in the middle of the day, and he pushes a button on a four-track tape recorder, and I hear the tracks to Good Morning, Good Morning. And, of course, that was burned into my brain forever after. I got back to the States, and I was directing and wrote and directed an episode of The Monkees, and I said, I really want to get that song on the Monkee episode. And I don't know who called who. I might have called Paul. I don't remember. And they gave us the rights to that song. And
cool. It's
on a Monkee episode. And to my knowledge, it's the first time they had ever let anything go like that. This is 69, you know, 68,
yeah.
69.
And of course, Good Morning, Good Morning would later show up on a Monkees episode as their alarm clock.
Exactly. The Frotis Caper, as a matter of fact.
The last one.
The last one. But now that we've talked about our favorite Monkee individual, I want to speak about each Monkee and what they brought to the band and the TV show. We'll start with Davy Jones. He was that English pop star right from the get-go. He melted a million girls' hearts, and he had a very good singing voice. I feel that sometimes the material he was given was not that great. For example, On the Day We Fall in Love. Not one of my favorites. But then he does something as amazing as Daydream Believer. And it's just stunning. It's that song really holds up to this day. It sounds fresh and new to me. You guys feel the same way, or?
Yeah, I think that's the beauty of any band where you have multiple singers, is you are basically able to really do a lot more types of songs. Whereas, you know, you sort of had Davey's really smooth voice that was great for ballads and really, really, really poppy stuff. And then you had Mickey, who could really belt it out. It's always great when you have multiple vocalists, and the Monkees, they were all really, really, really strong singers.
And when you think about, there's not many bands you can say that about. There's the Beatles, there's Kiss, the Monkees, and the Eagles. That's pretty much it, right?
Beach Boys.
Yeah, the Beach Boys, but yeah. As far as singing lead, everybody did harmonies, but the Beach Boys, to me, didn't have the personalities. Like, for example, you had you have Kiss, you have the Monkees, you have the Beatles. Each one of those were a strong personality. To me, it was kind of like, you know, Brian Love and, you know, the Wilson brothers. You know what I'm saying? It just didn't seem...
Oh, yeah, totally. I'm a huge Beach Boys fan, and I can even say that it took me years and years of listening to find, you know, to really figure out what songs Brian was singing on, as opposed to Al, who sounded a lot like Brian.
Right, right. We've discussed Michael Nesmith a little bit. You kind of wonder if the Monkees' takeover, their own career, would have happened had it not been for Michael Nesmith and Peter Tork. Because I think Mickey and Davey were just thrilled to be working, and after that wore off for Pete and Mike, they realized, wait a second, these guys aren't doing the same thing we thought we were doing. And I don't think that the Monkees ever would have became that band in that sense if it hadn't been for Mike Nesmith. And his strength as a songwriter cannot be denied.
And he was willing to punch his fist through a wall to prove his point.
Absolutely.
True. Well, and I think you have to give Peter a little bit of credit there, too, because the Monkees were essentially two actors and two musicians thrown together. And I think Peter was a pretty strong voice and an advocate of playing their own music as well.
Right. Yep. I think that if it just would have been Mike throwing a hissy fit or saying, look, this or I'm out of here, we would have seen a new wool hat. Yeah. But since it was Peter as well, I
think the great thing about Mike Nesmith, though, is the fact that a lot of quote-unquote pure musicians might have scoffed at the idea of auditioning for the Monkees, whereas Nesmith really saw it probably as an opportunity to get your foot in the door and then try and, you know, really inject your own personality into things, which is exactly what happened.
Hey, right. Steven Stills auditioned. We could have had, you know, could have been Crosby, Dolenz, and Nash.
That would have been so bizarre.
I don't know how that would have flown, but, you know, would have been interesting.
I'm not sure. But, yeah, Peter Tork's humor and what he brought to the TV show as well as his musicality cannot be denied. And like I said, if it just would have been Mike Nesmith raising a stink, we just might have had a new wool hat, and it would have been the three guys with this other guy. Here comes Carl, you know. It's very interesting how that all worked out. And then, of course, you've got the powerhouse, Mickey Dolenz. You cannot, to me, he is the Monkees in the sense his voice and his extreme comedy and what he's able to do with his body and his face. You know, kind of like what he projects when he's doing his goofy-ass comedy or his music. I cannot imagine the Monkees without Mickey Dolenz's voice. Thoughts, gentlemen? Jeff?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, I think if I'm not mistaken, he was voted one of, if not the best voice in rock and roll by some publication. I don't know if I would agree with that, him being the absolute best, but I remember when I saw him in 87, and I actually use this as an excuse to defend the Pulitzer record, was that as rough as some of the new tracks on the Pulitzer record were, Mickey's voice was still so strong, and he was able to really carry those tunes so well that they kind of transcended themselves in a way where they were kind of picked at the last minute and thrown together and just kind of dumped on a record to get the record out there. But he was still able to really put those tunes out there and sound just like he used to. Whereas a lot of singers with that kind of a gap between, you know, the end of their band and coming back, they kind of lose a little something. Mm-hmm. But Mickey still carried that through, you know, 20 years later.
Craig, what are your thoughts on Mickey Dolenz as a vocalist and as a comedian?
God, it's almost hard to determine which he's better at because he's so strong at both. I mean, Mickey was as physical as Peter could be. Mickey had this ability with his facial expressions to really sell a lot of the comedy, which is just, it's really hard to pull off. And vocally, he's on some of their most iconic songs. You know, probably most famously outside of the Monkees, you hear him on the sample of the Run DMC song, Mary Mary.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so he's definitely the most iconic voice in that band. And he is arguably one of the top rock vocalists of, you know, the last 50 years.
Very, very true, very true. Have you gentlemen ever heard of the Wichita Train Whistle Sings? It's an album by Michael Nesmith.
I've heard of it.
It was the first solo album by Michael Nesmith and was recorded while he was still a member of the Monkees. It peaked at number 144 on Billboard's pop album charts. It's a very bizarre album. On it are such songs as Nine Time Blue, Carlisle Wheeling, Tapioca Tundra, Don't Call on Me, Don't Cry Now, While I Cried, Papa Jean's Blues, You Just May Be the One, You Told Me, and Sweet Young Thing. You all know those tracks. Anyone listening to this probably knows those tracks. Mm. But what it was Mike owed about $50,000 to the IRS. And he decided, instead of giving that money to the IRS, what he was going to do was spend that money to make an album that he figured would flop anyway and use it as a tax write-off, the producing, the production cost. And it cost about $50,000. Nesmith explained to Hal Blaine that he was about to pay a similar sum in taxes and he would rather spend it on the sessions and write it off than give it to the IRS. Here's a little bit of Sweet Young Thing from that right now. So it's something that Monkee fans really probably didn't want to hear anyway. It was the members of the Wrecking Crew with a bunch of trumpets and trombones and drummers and percussionists and nothing that really would reach a 16-year-old kid at that point. But just an interesting story and a little bit of Monkee trivia. I always found it very interesting that he did that. It took some balls, if you ask me. Our next thing that we're going to talk about, what is your favorite Monkees album and why? Mr. Chris Karam.
Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn, and Jones Limited, the fourth album. I'm probably going to catch hell for saying this, but to me it's almost like they're Sgt. Pepper.
Ah.
And that's probably a bit of a stretch, but it's kind of, to me, the perfect balance between, you know, the Monkees playing on some tracks and the session guys and, you know, having some good songs. The song Hard to Believe kind of stands out like a sore thumb to me on that record, though. I could almost picture Davy Jones singing it on the Love Boat. You know, he'd be on the Lido deck doing the thing and doing the sway and charming Julie McCoy.
Ah.
But it's a great album. It's a lot of imagination. It may be the very first album to have a synthesizer on it, because Mickey had bought one of the first Moog synthesizers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think he got it directly from the manufacturer.
Absolutely.
And of course, back then they were just effects boxes, but he did use it. And there's just so much. There's a lot of experimental stuff on that album too. Maybe that's why I like it. You know. And of course, it's got Cuddly Toy, which, you know, makes you do the involuntary Davy Jones dance, and Words, which kind of used to scare me a little bit as a kid. But yeah, there's a lot of good stuff on that record. There's a lot of imagination. Although it was kind of the beginning of the end, though, for Peter Tork. Because I had listened to an interview with Peter Tork on a Boston talk radio show, and he said once they did that album, they went into what he called mixed mode, you know, where everybody was just kind of going off doing their own tracks with the session guys, and he said the Monkees for a band ended for him right there. You know, he was a big proponent of Headquarters and them being a group. I still love it. I think it's a great album, and it's the first album, too, where they actually acknowledge the session players on the back of the sleeve.
Yeah.
So they weren't trying to, you know, they weren't trying to mislead anybody anymore. But I don't think they actually ever misled anybody. I think it was the producers who put out that first record and said, you know, Mickey plays the drums, Davy plays the tambourine, you know.
And when you think about Pete's argument, you look at something like Teardrop City, which is basically Last Train to Clarksville kind of rewritten, and it was a throwaway track that wasn't good enough to be on any of the other Monkees album, and now it was their lead-off single when Instant Replay came out. So you could see where Pete was basically saying that we had become a band and now we're like throwing that away again. Mr. Jeff Hewlett, what is your favorite Monkees album?
This is another really tough one. So I'm going to do something that this is something that I do as a fan. When I get into bands very deeply, I try to differentiate between what I think is their best album versus the album I consider my favorite, or the one
good.
I like listening
very
to the most.
Very good point.
So what album I think is the best, I'm going to have to agree is with Chris and say is the Pisces album. I think it's the strongest commercially. I think it's a mature record. It's got them firing on all cylinders. But my favorite album to listen to is The Birds, the Bees, and the Monkees.
Ah, interesting choice.
Closely followed by Head.
Wow.
Head, that's a whole nother subject, and we'll probably leave that for a whole nother show because we could talk about that for hours, I'm sure.
Right.
But The Birds, the Bees, and the Monkees, I think, is a really interesting record in the fact that a lot of the songs, if you don't really dig into them, may sound like nonsense, but they're actually really deep. Songs like Auntie's Municipal Court and Tapioca Tundra are actually really deep lyrically if you listen to them, and they're very intricate, they're very layered, they're very fun to listen to. Then you have songs that were kind of written as throwaways, like The Poster, which is actually a really great tune. A P.O. Box 9847 and Valerie, kind of staple voice and heart tunes, Valerie being a pretty big hit. And I'll Be Back Upon My Feet, which had two different versions, one that was recorded much, much earlier, I think around the More of the Monkees era, and then this re-recording that has a whole big, long story behind it. This album as a whole, to me, is the most fun to listen to. None of the tracks ever really come across to me as skippable. And I think that the Rhino reissue box set actually made this an even better album. It's so much more immersive now, with the sound quality boosted so much over the original CD release. It really made me fall in love with it again when I picked it up.
But yet it's not brickwalled. I want people to know that. If you're on the fence, they're not brickwalled. They're excellent. They sound fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely right. You're right. It wasn't just an overall volume increase to create. They actually went back, took the master tapes, and remastered them properly.
Correct.
And gave you a real proper release tailored for the media it was being released for, with proper analog to digital conversion.
You cannot go wrong with the Monkees and Rhino.
Not at all.
Mr. Craig Cohen, your thoughts on your favorite album and why?
I really have to go with More of the Monkees from 1967.
Wow.
And for me, there's just so many songs on there that are just staples. You have She, you have Mary Mary, you have I'm Not Your Stepping Stone, which is one of my favorite Monkee songs. I just love the production on that. It's it's such a sort of stripped down sound, which I really, really like. And you also have I'm a Believer, which is such an iconic song for the Monkees. So asking me today at this moment, I'm saying More of the Monkees. Ask me again in 6 months and I might have a better answer.
Well, Craig, you know what? I'm going to make a confession here, and at the risk of incurring the wrath of our podfather, I don't even own a complete set of Monkees CDs.
Ah, okay.
What?
Give him hell, Jeff.
And in fact, I'm regretting the fact now that I passed up, you know, those Rhino Deluxe boxes of the releases you talked about, because I wasn't sure if I really, you know, if those records were good enough that to warrant, you know, two or three CDs. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now from what you guys are telling me, I'm starting to regret it, and I think I'm going to have to start seeking out the other CDs in the Monkees catalog.
Excellent. And we hope that we do turn some people on to some Monkees music.
Kingdom.
far as my favorite album, I'm going to cheat because I can't do this. I just can't do this.
Oh, come on, Ken.
I can't do it. I'm going to say that it goes, battles out today between Headquarters and Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn, and Jones. It's kind of tough. I mean, one's got Pleasant Valley Sunday. Another one's got Randy Scouse Git. One's got Shade of Gray. And, you know, you can do this all day.
You forgot Pierre Percival Patterson's Pet Pig Porky.
Porky, yes, absolutely.
He popped, you know.
My God, you know, it's a great 1-2 punch, and it's also them at the height of them being a band, them working together as a unit and trying to produce something. And one cannot discuss the Monkees without mentioning people like, you know, Don Kirshner or Chip Douglas, who was in the Turtles. And Chip Douglas did some absolutely amazing stuff with them. And so I'm torn between Headquarters, Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn and Jones. So sue me, beat me about the head and shoulders, I'm sorry, but that's the best answer I can give you right now. And I've been to Into Head a lot as of late. It's great. For the last year, that album just keeps getting stronger and stronger. Just amazing stuff. They
so
definitely
many great
went
songs
out
on that album.
What was that?
I said there's so many really truly great songs on that album, and I think as we go along, it may be one of the best ballads they've ever done.
Yeah, absolutely.
Beautiful, beautiful song.
I think I'm going to play that right now.
Okay.
Aren't you surprised there aren't more Monkees tribute bands?
That's interesting. Yeah, there's tons and tons of Beatles ones.
Yeah.
But yeah. I don't think I've seen a Monkees one.
I've seen some, and I wish I hadn't.
Who here has actually seen the Monkees live?
Me.
Not me.
I did.
I saw them in 1987. That was the only time.
Yeah, I saw them in 2000.
But it's good that they're still out there doing it and enjoying it, and it's nice to see Mike come back to the fold.
It's just hard for me to imagine, though, a Monkey show without Davy Jones. I mean, Davy Jones, though, you know?
Yeah.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around that one. But
I was shocked.
Yeah.
I think all of us were, and it's been hard dealing with Davy's death. And someone might be listening to this and say, why? I didn't know Davy Jones, but he was a part of my childhood. He was a part of my innocence. He was part of my laughter. When part of your laughter goes away, it's kind of sad. The good thing is thanks to Rhino, we have the DVD sets, and we can enjoy the Monkees just about any time we want. Even on YouTube, if you don't have the DVD, you can see them on Antenna TV, or you can see them on YouTube. There's whole episodes on there. So we encourage people to check them out. If you have any questions about the Monkees, let us know. Contact us through the various podcast means. I don't know about you guys, but I enjoyed this. It was nice to talk about something other than Kiss and Cheap Trick, and it was just nice to talk the Monkees.
Yeah,
oh, totally.
Great. I know there wasn't an incredibly informative podcast for anybody. We want to get into the round tables and talking about episodes and things like that, but it was just an enjoyable discussion about a really good TV show and a really good band. So I'd like to thank you, Chris Karam, for being part of this tonight, Mr. Craig Cohen, and Mr. Jeff Hewlett. We'd like people to check out your Tricorder Transmission. That's the name of your show, correct?
Yes, sir. Tricorder Transmission. So we're available on Twitter at TTT_pod. You can find us at facebook.com/thetricordertransmissions or thetricordertransmissions.com.
And I want to thank you for beaming aboard tonight.
Ha!
And I hope to beam back aboard on your show sometime, and the cross-pollination of podcasting will continue. The variant crossover, chromium cover crossover event will continue, so it'll be fine.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it, and we're going to steal Chris away as well and hopefully bring him on as well.
Absolutely.
Very
good. I can tell you already have two family members who are going to give me so much grief for doing a Star Trek show, but I love it.
Oh, you got to come on, man.
No, they're just as geeky as I am about it.
Nice. Oh,
I was afraid that their metachlorine rate was too high.
Oh, boy. Star Wars reference.
And, you know, you've given me a new term to think about, audiophile uncle. It sounds like a creepy uncle who has a great sounding system, though.
So let's dedicate this to all those uncles and aunts that turned us on to music. Seriously. My wife, she became a Monkees fan because of her aunt. My aunts and my mom and my uncle, they turned me on to tons of great music. Everything from Alice Cooper, the Beatles, just everything. Rod Stewart, just about anything that came out. You know, it came through them. And Jeff, you were discussing your uncle. You know, so let's dedicate this to our aunts and uncles and all the people that took time to let us go through their record collections.
Yeah, man. You know, as corny as audiophile uncle sounds when you say it, I honestly, it sounds mushy, but I do not think that I would have the musical tastes and the breadth of experience musically that I have today if it had not been for his influence. And his influence only. Actually, I tell him that all the time. I say, thank you for giving me the musical taste that I have today, or else I'd be stuck listening to top 40 dance music. Yeah. Like everybody else.
Amen. Amen. That's a good way of looking at it.
Before we end this, though, I think we should all take a vow right now that we never discuss the new Monkees.
Oh, God, no.
No, we have to talk about the new Monkees.
Yeah, I guess we do.
Ugh, I shouldn't have said it.
How not to do it.
Yeah. Actually, I have one thing that I think would be really cool to add to the agenda somewhere down the road. Is anybody familiar with the 1976 Dolan Jones Boyce and Hart record?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So that was kind of billed by some people as a quote-unquote Monkees reunion.
Yep.
So that might prove to be an interesting discussion topic, and maybe some people don't even know about it.
Yeah, I think that's something that we definitely have to add to the show. Well, let me ask you guys this. Anybody watch Nickelodeon?
Not anymore, but I used
to. Me neither, yeah.
Okay, has anyone ever seen a TV show called Big Time Rush?
No.
Yeah.
Okay. Craig, you've seen it.
Yeah.
It's pretty much the Monkees.
Yeah, now that you mention it, yeah.
I mean, there's everything from, instead of, you know, the landlord upstairs, they have their mom that lives there, and then they have the guy who's always trying to run him out of the hotel. But if you guys get a chance, both Chris and Jeff, watch a few episodes. They're stupid, so weren't the Monkees.
Okay.
Their music's inane pop, and if you were your age back in 1968, yep, you probably would have thought the same thing about the Monkees. Yep. But it's more danceable type music, and it's the guys falling in love, they meet a girl, there's like some that you swear to God are right out of a Monkees episode, like one of them falls in love with an Arabian princess or something.
Nice.
And there's even where they fight with the loaves of bread and they've got the Arabian costumes on, you're like going, I wonder where we've seen this before, you know. But if you want to see a show that's very similar in spirit and tone to the Monkees, check it out.
Okay. I'll give it a spin.
And I even like their music. I know that Craig's probably going to throw a brick at me, but I don't ever apologize for the music I like. I don't believe in something called guilty pleasures. There's things I like and things I don't.
Neither do I, Ken. That's a great attitude.
Hooray for Davey! You know, basically, I'm a very non-violent person.
Oh, really? That's very refreshing.
Oh. Hooray for Peter!
Well, that wraps up another laugh riot. And this is Mike Nesmith, Mickey Dolenz,
and Peter Tom,
and Davy Jones,
and Mickey Dolenz, reminding you to save the Texas prairie chicken.
Boom, boom. Here we come, walking down the street. We get
everybody is loose from everyone we meet.
Well, thank you for listening to our first episode zero, Zilch. We'll be back at some point with Monkees episode number one, and we will talk about the first Monkees album. So thank you for listening. And here we go.
Walking down the street. We get the funniest looks.
Everyone we meet.
Oh, we're not the Monkees.
Oh, Spanish version, sorry. Oh,
you were doing the Podkees? Oh, okay.
And that's our show. Zilch is an online, nonprofit Monkees audio fanzine made by fans for fans. Any samples of music or interviews heard remain property of their owners. We are not related to the Monkees or any of their members past or present. We are not affiliated with Rhino or Ray Burke. If you hear anything you like from the band, go on Amazon or iTunes and buy it. If you enjoyed the show, like us on Facebook and rate us on iTunes. Thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm your announcer, Chelsea Epstein, saying always take some time to monkey around.
You are listening to the Podkiss Network.
You're listening to Zilch, a Monkees podcast.
That's right, gang. You requested it. Finally, a monthly Monkees podcast is coming your way. Follow us as we discuss the adventures of Mickey, Mike, Davey, and Peter. That's right, the Monkees. Take some time out of your busy day and monkey around with us. So join us on Zilch, the podcast full of Monkees. I'm also adding to the agenda, who is your favorite monkey? And my wife is sitting approximately 25 feet from me, and she will occasionally scream blasphemy. My wife's a huge Mickey girl, so I am a Mike guy, and she tells me I'm wrong all the time.
Are you wearing a wool hat for this episode?
I am wearing a wool hat, but I won't tell you where. Wow. Jeff's just butt hurt because we didn't go with Podkees, so...
Oh, come on, that was a joke. I'd rather go with the Wool Hat Podcast.
The Wool Hat.
I wonder how many gangster rappers Mike Nesmith inspired with that wool hat.
Well, I remember being at a movie theater in a mall, and there was all these kids in the middle of summer, like August, hottest day of the year. They've got these stocking caps on. My wife at the time said, why are they doing that? I said, they just want to be Mike Nesmith. So,
the easiest Halloween costume ever.
Yeah, the easiest Halloween. Well, you need a red shirt with the four white buttons and a wool cap.
And wool cap.
You're done.
Pretty easy.
Yep. Has anyone ever tried to do that thing where Davey would pull the gun and have your belt fall down? Has anyone ever done that?
No, my pants fall down by themselves just
fine.
Well,
there you go. I remember trying to do that. When we got to be 17, we lived in a place in Ohio called Pamatuning Lake. And it was so bizarre because we would go to the beach almost every day, and then we would work at the drive-in. We'd go and pick up garbage and stuff through the day, you know, before the show started, before the crowds came back in. And the guy would let us watch the movies for free. So for very little money, we saw every movie that came out that year, and we would go to the beach. And we'd go to the beach, and the big joke was every day was like a Monkees episode because we'd go to the beach and fall in love with a different girl. One of us, one of the four guys. There was Billy, Branton, Eric, and me. And we'd go to the beach, and one of us would meet a girl, and I swear to God, you'd see a girl, and there'd be a twinkle in her eye. And it was, I always thought of
little cartoon hearts.
Yeah. And it was lots of fun because we lived halfway between Pittsburgh and Cleveland. And if the girls said Yuns, you could go, you're from Pittsburgh. And they'd go, how did you know? And a great opening. But yeah. So we were kind of like our own little monkey group.
You've just been podcast.